Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking apart this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I'm Steve Topple. It's Sunday, the 9th of December, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. We're on episode 4 already. Check that out. So, it's only 16 sleeps till Christmas. Blah. If, like Theresa May, you're probably not feeling very festive at all, I don't know, you may have had your chestnuts roasted like her on an open fire. You may have flicked the switch on your festive bush outside your front door in front of a group of schoolchildren, a fifth of whom would have been in poverty thanks to your policies. Or you've got no wise men in your party anywhere to be found. Then fear not, I have the perfect antidote. So, snuggle up, sweeties, it's cold outside. Grab yourself a hot toddy, get yourself an organic, ethically sourced vegan mince pie, sit back, relax, and enjoy the next 20-odd minutes. Are you ready? Are you steady? Let's go. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. You know what this section is. It is Plucked News, where I take some of the top stories from this week and give them the narrative that you are not going to get in the mainstream press. So, 5 topics, 5 minutes. Can I do it? Let's see. 3, 2, 1. Let's go. First off, it's over to The Guardian, and they ran a story called EU support for austerity opens the door to far right, Corbyn said. This was, of course, the story of Jeremy Corbyn being in Lisbon this week, meeting left-wing leaders from across the EU. They were discussing Brexit, the future of the European Union, and neoliberalism more broadly. But, of course, hardly any of the press picked up on it. It was only The Guardian and Sky News which actually even mentioned this summit. Why didn't they report it? Firstly, two things. Corbyn's speech was fascinating. He essentially said that if Labour got into power, they would renegotiate the EU withdrawal deal and then start to build a left-wing movement across Europe. Of course, the mainstream press are terrified of this. Corporatist EU being taken down from the inside out? Surely not. This is fascinating from the Labour leader. Watch what he says on this. This could be something very big building here. Secondly, they didn't report it because this is part of a broader plan by Corbyn. Not only was he in Lisbon this week, he also met with the Mexican leader and the Venezuelan leader at the former's inauguration. He is starting to make moves geopolitically in the hope that he may well get into government and therefore be in a better position to strike trade deals with other countries, in my opinion. Corbyn is making some serious moves internationally in a minute. Next up, we're off to Russia today, and they reported that, like execution by firing squad, videos of French students arrested by armed police stirs outrage. This is the most shocking story of this week. French police rounded up 157 students who were protesting Macron's educational reforms as part of the wider Yellow Vest movement, made them kneel for hours on end with their hands above their heads, like it was a firing squad, like they were going to be executed, and yet this is somehow acceptable to the French authorities. This just, my mind was blown by this story. These students weren't violent. Yes, some of them reportedly had baseball bats, but this is just going on police sources. How this is acceptable in France, I have no idea. But of course it is, because we are seeing this creeping authoritarianism everywhere. From the UK Investigatory Powers Act to the conduct of French police, to the clampdowns we're seeing in the US. It is just staggering that the police feel they can act in this manner. While politicians were outraged, there is too many people questioning us on Twitter. This is unacceptable behaviour, and everyone should be taking a stand against this now. And if you think it could only happen in France, just you wait till this shit starts happening over here. Next up, we're off to US website The Hill, and they reported that State Department official, China holding 800,000 Muslim minorities in internment camps. This is a staggering story that has been rumbling on now for several months, and it's not really getting the attention it deserves. Chinese authorities are essentially conducting an apartheid regime in their country. They are sectioning off whole portions of communities that are Muslim minorities, sending them to internment camps for essentially retraining. We've heard that before. And yet the world is passing this by and not doing anything about it. But here's the problem. This sums up China's situation in a nutshell. Essentially, it is still an authoritarian communist country, but yet is it embracing capitalism. By its own admission, it is trying to turn its economy towards a more Western model, which is all about consumerism and output as opposed to manufacturing. And the two things, while not always compatible, seem to be going hand in hand. We have authoritarian dictatorship meeting crony capitalism, and the result is going to be a disaster. But what's also interesting with this story is you are seeing wider geopolitical moves against China at the minute. You have the clampdown on Huawei and the arrest of one of its senior executives in Canada. You also have the falling the part of relations between the US and China. This is playing into a wider narrative in a minute, but let this be very clear. This is a terrible story. China, you're an authoritarian dictatorship, and the world needs to know as such. And for story number four, we're off to my mate Jay Watts, clinical psychologist and activist. She tweeted that when asked by John Pring Disability News Service at the press conference yesterday why the Mental Health Rights Review had not recommended full implementation of the UN Convention, Wesley, pictured right, said, "Those kind of recommendations go too far." What? This is the story of the review of the Mental Health Act conducted by Sir Simon Weasley, Simon Wesley, basically fitting into the current government line of pushing people with mental health issues back to work and saying that they are responsible for their own treatment, which is absolutely wrong. But moreover, Simon Wesley is the notorious clinical psychologist behind the flawed PACE trial, the study into treatments for myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME, that found that people should just think themselves better and take exercise. This is the biggest medical scandal in history, according to Carol Monaghan, SNP MP, who's currently organising a debate in Parliament about this. And Wesley was behind part of this, and yet he still gets knighted, and yet BBC News still parade him on primetime television on Thursday night. Why? Because he is an establishment mouthpiece. He is working hand in glove with the government to dismiss people with mental health issues, to deny them treatment, and especially people living with ME, to leave them abandoned, without benefits, without insurance, basically left on the scrap heap. This man is a danger in the medical profession, and him reviewing the Mental Health Act is just a kick in the face for everyone, not only living with ME, but people living with mental health issues as well. And last but not least, we're off to my home, the Canary, and my mate Chris Jarvis. He wrote that two scandals over inequality hit the UK's elite universities in just 24 hours. This is a two-pronged story. Firstly, research by the BBC found that out of 24 Russell Group universities, the majority of them were paying their white academics £52,000 a year. By contrast, black academics were paid on average £38,000 a year. What's this? White people being paid more than people of colour? Surely not. The second part of the story is also research by the Sutton Trust. It found that just eight elite schools sent as many students to Oxbridge as nearly three quarters of all other schools and colleges across the UK. It also found that students from independent schools are seven times more likely to receive a place at Oxbridge, that is Oxford and Cambridge. Why does this matter? Because at the root of both these stories is classism. Essentially, that if you go to a better school, if your parents have more money, then you can get the best education. But of course, there's a bigger point to this story, and it is going to university really the best form of education anyway? These Russell Group universities essentially teach people to think in the same way, to act in the same way, and to have their outlook on life the same. And this elitism that pervades our university structures in this country just plays into that. We need to get away from the notion that a university education is the be-all and end-all of succeeding in life. It's not. They encourage elitism, manufacture classism, and just make society worse, in my opinion. And handing their time to talk about the New York University student government body passing a boycott, divest, and sanction movement against Israel. There seems to be an increasing movement for BDS in the US, with a US senator coming out last week saying she supports BDS. Good stuff. Keep this going, in my opinion. Nor have I had time to talk about Labour's Shadow Minister for Disabled People, Marsha D. Cordova, being given an inaccessible room for her meeting on the UN International Day for Disabled People. This is absolutely staggering. Parliament, what were you thinking? You didn't even consider disabled people's needs when appointing this room? But it just underscores the fact that to the government, disabled people are there to be thrown on the scrap heap anyway. And I really must fit in a quick shout out to, firstly, Peter Stavanovich, who announced on Saturday that he'd had 50 million views of his videos with the Communication Workers Union this year. 50 million views? That's more than the BBC. And I want to give a quick shout out to The Agitator, my mate over on Twitter, who's organising a massive Twitter storm on Monday night, 7:45 p.m, preceding the vote for Brexit on Tuesday. Check out his handle, it's at UK Democracy for more details. And finally, I hadn't even had time to mention the Brexit deal. My God, what's going on here? And essentially, this is a blatant attempt by the EU and the Conservative Party to undermine Labour, as I previously discussed on this programme. It will install mechanisms that means that state support cannot be given to industries, and it will make taking private companies into public hands even harder. This is a blatant move against Labour, and it's little wonder Jeremy Corbyn's going around the world trying to interact with other left-leaning governments. That's it. Pluck News, over and done with for another week. I think I need to lie down after that one. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, free-flying with... I'm very excited this week for my Free Flying With section, because I have a very good friend of mine joining me, and she's a journalist and a media consultant focusing on fracking and environmental issues. And many of you will know her. She does some absolutely blinding work around the issue of shale gas and fracking and the negative implications that holds. It's only Claire Stevenson. Hello, Claire.
Hello. Thanks so much for asking me to be on.
Oh, no, thank you for joining me. I've worked with you for years now on fracking, and you're my instant choice to get on this week because fracking is something I cover a lot, but I haven't really talked about it in depth. So that's one of the topics we're going to be covering today, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Coming in on fracking. We have got three stories, as always, listeners. One was chosen by Twitter, one is Claire's choice, and one is my choice. So we're going to start off with Twitter. You chose this, and it was my story from the Canary, which was the media hit peak of toxicity with its analysis of Corbyn at Prime Minister's questions. This is essentially the story of Corbyn leading on poverty, food banks, and the UN Special Rapporteur Philip Alston's report into the UK government. He led on this at Prime Minister's questions amid all the Brexit chaos, but the mainstream press, they weren't happy with that. They lashed out, and Nick Robinson, for example, tweeted, "Given the chance of a head-to-head debate with the PM on Brexit the day after a historic series of defeats for the government, Jeremy Corbyn chooses to use his 6 questions of PMQs to ask about something else." That something else is 14 million people in poverty in this country, 4 million of them being children, 2/3 of them being in households where there is one parent working. Claire, do you think Corbyn was right to lead on the issues surrounding poverty and food banks in this country, or should he have droned on about Brexit again?
Oh, for goodness sake. You know, it's so predictable when you turn on Prime Minister's questions now, how many questions aren't actually answered. So, you know, yes, he could have asked about Brexit, but really, is he going to get any new answers? And the fact is that the poverty and inequality in this country is skyrocketing. Not only are we talking about the UN report that was recently released, the Joseph Rowntree report recently, that child poverty is rising. You know, so how are we going to address this? But more worryingly, it's in work poverty. You know, people can't actually afford to go to work. It's costing them a ridiculous amount in childcare, and their rents are not being met. And the response you get from the Tory benches is laughter.
It was staggering, wasn't it? I mean, the thing is, Claire, we've seen this before. They always do this. So it's like Corbyn is banging his head against a brick wall, as it were. But of course, the media brushed over the issue of poverty, as they quite often always do, and rounded on him again. And this is there's a constant theme with Corbyn that the media hate him. Do you think this constant bias against Corbyn in the media, do you think that feeds through to the electorate? Do you think the public are lapping this kind of propaganda up, or are they becoming more wise?
Yeah, I think the latter. The obvious rise in social media has led to people being able to access news, you know, on all levels. It's not just having to wait for the next print of the newspaper. People are recognising now that, you know, some of the mainstream media channels and broadcasters are inherently biased. And it's just a presentation of something that, you know, isn't acceptable to general people in society. You know, avoiding topics like poverty, you know, if Corbyn didn't mention it, it would never get brought up.
Yeah. As
you could see, May instantly dismiss, you know, she disagrees with it, you know, but it's happening. It's happening now. So what are we going to do about that? If Corbyn didn't bring it up, nobody would talk about it.
Absolutely, yes. But as you say, it's something that either the media sort of brush over and give us just the statistics and don't really go in depth on why this is happening, or when Corbyn brings it up, it gets dismissed because of Brexit. But we see the same thing with fracking quite often, don't we, Claire? Which is the next subject we're going to go in on. In the past few days, Quadrilla, the notorious shale gas extraction company, as I have to call them, which is currently operating at Preston New Road, a site in Lancashire, they've come out and said that they want to propose amendments to the government's traffic light warning system. That is a series of levels at which if earth tremors occur but above a 0.5 magnitude, then fracking has to cease at the site for 18 hours. Quadrilla want to raise this level. They want the earthquakes to allow to be stronger so they don't have to stop fracking at this 0.5 magnitude level. Do you think the government is going to concede to Quadrilla on this, given the fact that Energy Minister Claire Perry and the government's new fracking czar Natasha Engels, they're seemingly pro-shale?
I think they find it very difficult politically and socially to progress this any further.
Okay.
Socially, fracking is an absolute time bomb. It's one of the most heavily opposed extraction techniques there are. And to force it onto communities just shows an absolute contempt and lack of regard for people's health and safety. And I think to start messing with these levels when Quadrilla, I mean, what are we on now? 37 earthquakes in the short time that they've fracked?
Yeah, since the 18th of October, isn't it?
18th of October, yeah. They haven't fracked since the 28th of October, we're led to believe. This just proves how this isn't a commercial viability. You know, shareholders are bailing.
Yes, I saw your great tweet by you, actually. I'll put it in the show notes.
I mean, these are the shareholders for AJ Lucas, so it's an Australian-led shareholders forum. So they aren't informed. You know, they don't have the understanding of the opposition on the ground. They don't have the political land lie here. You know, they aren't given the information of, you know, chucking good money after bad. It's not been an easy journey for them. And, you know, what we're talking, 7 or 8 years they've been investing, some of them.
Yeah.
It's a long time to have no returns and just to see your investment devalued week after week.
Absolutely so, yes. For me, because I bang on about fracking a lot, firstly, because the opposition to fracking and the community-led movements in this country are becoming so effective at what they do. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic, especially what we see in Lancashire. The other reason I focus on it is, for me, it is peak corporatist capitalism, where you have these blurred lines between where corporations begin and where the government ends, and essentially the government's effectively in the pockets of these shale gas operators.
The lobbying behind closed doors, and you see, you know, with failed politician Natasha Engel, she's gone from Labour to INEOS, back to government. You know, the revolving doors are just permanently greased and ready. And it's just a shambles, really.
It is, absolutely, yes. The government squeal repeatedly. All the scientific evidence, blah, blah, blah. As with many things in government, it's their scientific evidence which suits them. The opposite view on this, of course, is that the scientific evidence from independent people presents the risk of water contamination. Obviously, we've seen the risk of earthquakes, low birth weights, breast cancer, premature births, not least to mention the greenhouse gas emissions.
Michael Gove is still prospecting shale as the solution, and it totally fits with a green future. You know, it's just absolutely ridiculous to consider opening up a new fossil fuel industry when we know we're in a dire emergency and we need to decarbonize fast.
Absolutely. I mean, it is staggering, and I don't think this topic is going to be resolved overnight, to be honest. Segueing rather nicely into our final topic, when we're talking about environmental emergencies and catastrophe, the Yellow Jackets protests in France. So these are ongoing. At the time of recording this, which was Friday morning, President Macron has given some concessions to these protesters in France. But what I found fascinating about this, Claire, is that the protesters, it's been very organic. There's no sort of figurehead of them, as it were. It's been a natural development that these protests have increased. Also, that it's across the political spectrum, from people from the right, people from the far left, over to anarchists. The media is presenting these people as it's all about these tax rises, etc., 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 which I don't think it is. What is your take on these protests? Because obviously it's a bit of a quandary from an environmental perspective as well. We would like diesel to be more heavily taxed, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think, you know, originally that was the instigating moment for people to take action over that. But as these protests and you know, anger has evolved, we see that it's a deeper seated problem within France and Macron's presidency. Mm. People are unimpressed with Macron's capitalist agenda. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even one protester had cited, he said, Macron's arrogance unites us all.
Yeah.
So he's seen as a leader that isn't in touch with his people or the understanding of the problems they face. And interestingly, you know, like you, I was quite interested in the sociological spread of people who are taking part in this protest and how it's been literally Facebook led, you know, and the algorithms that Facebook's changed just push the protests up.
Your point about Facebook, that's actually a fascinating one. I hadn't even considered that, because, of course, Facebook has changed its algorithm, so news gets pushed off people's timelines. But that's brilliant. Consequently, of course, what's happened is that everyone's
free promotion.
Yes. I hadn't even considered that. That's a brilliant point, Claire.
Yes, it's been pushed into all news feeds because it's such a hot topic and people are responding. They're liking it, which works with the algorithm, and it's just been pushed up to absolute prominence. So this is a huge problem for him. I think his approval ratings, the latest poll, is they've dropped to 18%. For somebody leading a country, this is really not a good look.
It's awful, isn't it? Absolutely. It's not a good look at all. What's interesting for me about this, I think that the protests in France at the minute, and of course they're now spiralling over into Belgium, the Netherlands, I think they encapsulate a broader problem, though, because obviously what Macron, on the face of it, I'm not going to believe every word he says and take his policies as a given, but on the face of it, increasing the tax on diesel was seen as an environmental move. But however, what these protests, I think, have encapsulated more than anything is also people's anger at the fact that the blame for this and the responsibility and the onus to make changes is, we see it being pushed onto people regarding climate change. When, as you know as well as I do, it's not blooming people that's the problem. You only have to look at the report which said that over the past 30 years, 70% of greenhouse gas emissions have been down to 100 corporations. And I think this protest kind of represents that, and also represents a major headache for governments across the world, really, because people are going to be angry that this sort of notion of original sin, that is all our fault, is going to be pushed onto us. What's your take on that?
I think with the start of Extinction Rebellion, especially in this country. You've seen people taking to the streets because they have no other options left. Just another point that I found really interesting about these protests in France over the so-called fuel tax is that it's single parents that have been hit by low wages and high rent. A lot of commentary coming from those within the French protests, and that they just physically can't afford to be paying higher taxes for these things.
Again, it goes back to the fact this is not a sort of metropolitan elite protest. These people are sort of from outlying north and western regions of France, from small villages where their way of life is essentially based on the use of a car. And
they're already struggling,
and this is going to hit them even more. And this is going to be the challenge for all Western governments over the next few years. But it's also going to be a challenge for us as citizens, how we respond to these governments. And I think for a lot of the condemnation about the Yellow Jacket movements, I think this is going to be the way forward, and we're going to see lots more of this. So, as we will with fracking, of course. Claire, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me on Topple Uncaged this Sunday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Guys, if you want to follow Claire on Twitter, it's @lady_Claire_UK. Make sure you follow her. Claire, great stuff. Thank you so much.
Take care, Steve.
Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Topple chirps back. This week's question time was a shit show of epic proportions, more so than usual, if that's even possible. Firstly, you have David Dimbleby constantly talking down to and not letting speak Labour's Shami Chakrabarti. You could physically see the anger rising in her, and who can blame her? I was getting angry for her. The treatment of her this week on Question Time is disgusting. Secondly, it was Brexit, 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 Brexit again. 45 minutes of goddamn Brexit this week. Yes, I know it's a constitutional crisis. Yes, I know it's the centre of everything that's going on in the minute. But there are other things going on in this country. Question Time, why do you keep ignoring this? So, what have you got for me this week, Question Time? First one, please.
Isn't it time Labour and other MPs stop fantasising about getting a better Brexit deal and instead back a real deal on Tuesday?
The real deal? I'm sorry, what is this real deal nonsense? A near permanent backstop with Ireland, which could leave the whole of the nation impoverished and leave us with a hard border with the country? That's not a real deal. A real deal that means Labour won't be able to implement hardly any of its policies because there's been a concerted effort by both the EU and the Conservative Party to bring this about. That's not a real deal. I'm not sure what planet you are living on, but none of this is a real deal for the people of this country. It's not even pleasing leavers. Next question, please.
David Attenborough warned that climate change was one of the biggest threats to humanity. I'm 16 years old and I can see these changes and effects. Why aren't politicians doing enough?
I have a very simple answer to that question. It's called corporatist capitalism. Too many of our politicians are embedded with fossil fuel making companies and those which profit from the degradation of our society, the climate and our ecological systems. Of course these politicians aren't going to make decisions that are in the best interests of the people. And if you think for 1 second the impending climate catastrophe and ecological crisis is going to be resolved by our parliamentarians, you've got another thing coming. They have too many vested interests, they are too swayed by corporations, and everything they're offering at the moment is piecemeal. The only way things are going to change is by us, the people, doing something about it. Next question, please.
Does the panel agree with the Met police officers knocking into suspected moped criminals, knocking them off their bikes during high-speed pursuit?
I'm unsure what planet people live on who would think that this is even acceptable in the first place. Not only is it creating more of a divide in communities by pitting the police against young people, but it's a creep in authoritarianism that we've already seen in France this week, with them lining up 157 students like they're going to be executed, and it will do nothing to solve the real issues of moped crime, that is poverty, inequality, and racial harassment that are embedded in this country. The police have absolutely no right to be going around knocking people off their mopeds with this militarianism-style method. It's absolutely outrageous and is going to do nothing to solve some of the problems that these communities face. And that is all I have to say on the shit show of this week's Question Time. So, until next week, Question Time, thank you. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I love my music section every week because I get to talk to some of the most incredibly talented people going. And this week is no exception to that rule. I'm joined by the incredible singer-songwriter Miri. Miri, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. What an introduction. That's amazing.
You are fascinating. Looking at your repertoire, it's really intriguing. Do you know what's so intriguing about it and what I loved instantly about you as a musician? I can't put my finger on what type of music you do. And that's always a good sign for me, because you listen to some of your songs, like Electric Vibes, for example, and I think, okay, well, that's kind of poppy. And then I think, well, no, it isn't. There's kind of sort of indie and folky elements in there.
Yeah.
And then I listen again and I'm like, well, hang on, is that reggae I'm hearing a bit? Because there appears to be a bit of a bubble rhythm going on as well. Where is this eclecticness, if you like, come from?
I feel it's because I just listen to so many different styles of music. As a kid, I just loved my Motown and soul. Mm. And then I loved pop, folk. I love artists like Nick Drake. And then I love a lot of reggae and roots as well. It's just, I just find if I hear a song and it speaks to me, it doesn't matter what genre it is. So I guess what I keep consistent in my music is the way that I sing. And then I guess the music or the songs I write, I don't think I could just sit down and be like, right, this is my genre. So I just kind of flow with it, and definitely just inspired by so many different sounds.
No, absolutely. And it really, it comes through in your music. You played at a gig organised by Natty. How was it working with Natty?
It was amazing. I think I did two of the Vibes and Pressure. And yeah, it was just, again, it was a really special moment for me, because I know there'd been so many artists or emerging artists who had got on to performing, but that they were quite selective. And I knew how important it was, like a very special moment for me. So, and I love Natty. I love watching him perform as well. That was a really, really great experience.
How did this all come about? What started you off as a singer? What drove you to this point?
Well, I kind of was actually really set on acting and wanted to make films. And I just sort of started writing songs as a kid, but it was more just a way to express myself. I never thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be like, you know, I want to pursue this as a singer-songwriter. I just never really saw that I had that sort of skill. And then I recorded some songs. Like, when I left school, I did a little short film. It wasn't amazing. It wasn't a masterpiece, but I just wrote some songs for the short film. And my late singing teacher passed them on to a contact he had, a friend of his who worked at a peer music publishing, A&R. And the guy was just like, really loved what I did. And I guess, long story short, that sort of experience showed me, okay, so I really enjoy this. I'm enjoying this more than the film process. And this is showing me that I can actually pursue this as a career. I feel the older I get, the more I know myself, the more I can empower myself as a person, as an artist, and the more I feel that I'm able to use my music as a channel to express how I feel, that can hopefully connect and resonate with other people.
Again, what I like about you as an artist, you do a lot of sort of socially conscious work, don't you? You're heavily involved in quite a few groups, not least the Blue Monday night.
That's something very close to my heart. I've been co-promoting and co-hosting that night with my friend Rose Red for 8 years now. We're a monthly live music event, and we're created for LGBTQ women and allies, so everyone is welcome. But I know people don't always like saying safe space, but I do think it's important to say, in the world that we're living in, not everyone is LGBTQ+ friendly. So it's really important to be able to create spaces that people can feel safe and comfortable in to be themselves, as well as making sure that we make sure the audience is attentive, so the artists perform and they're actually heard, so they're singing their heart and soul out and people aren't talking. So that's really important to us as well. And that actually led to a music venue in Camden called Green Note discovering us. Okay. And we've started to run nights with them, ticketed events with them called Girls to the Front, which is about bringing female musicians to the forefront and also working towards equality on the live gig circuit. And we've done nine so far, and they've all sold out. And we originally were just going to do one, and then it sold out in advance, and Greeno were like, shall we do another one? We're like, all right, then. And here we are, and we've got our 10th one January the 27th. So it's all kind of just, yeah, following what feels right. And another thing we do at Blue Monday as well, we started about 2-3 years ago having guest speakers. I remember actually I was watching a documentary, I think it was called Hunted, and it was talking about what was going on with Russia and how the LGBT community were being treated. And you know, it was just... yeah, just really distressing. And so I thought, you know, I can do something now, surely. So I got in contact with Stonewall and asked them if they could come and chat at Blue Monday and just sort of show us, okay, what can we do to help? And so that's, I think, how the getting the guest speakers started. So, we have creatives who want to share their projects as well as causes that we might feel passionate about, to be like, look, would you be cool to come down and chat about what you do? And it's just a few minutes before the live music kicks off. And that's also been, yeah, just really special, just bringing people together really as well, which is just majorly important.
That's so good, because we talk about this a lot on this podcast. On top of that as well, not that you're busy enough obviously already, you've got a new EP out next year, haven't you? It's called Soundbites. Yeah. What can we expect from that?
We are going to have something a bit more grittier. It's an opportunity for, I guess, I've been gigging so much and also doing a lot more stripped back gigs with just me on keys, and it's just really allowed me to just use my voice as an instrument and just sing out. And so I really wanted to capture that in my next recording. So Soundbites is going to have 5 tracks, all being well. The first single will be released next April, May. It's basically just sound bites of my life. So it's kind of like different things that have affected me, whether it's personal, whether it's political, and just sharing that. And again, like I said earlier, just hoping that can resonate with people as well as me having this EP to channel and express how I feel about things going on in the world or personal experiences. So I'm really, really excited. I was in the studio on Tuesday night recording some vocals and some guitar, and it just feels right.
Good,
you know?
Fantastic. And I'm not even going to ask you, you will be coming back on this podcast to discuss your first single.
Oh, I would love to, yeah.
Miri, that's fantastic. You're great. I love talking to people like you. Thank you so much for coming on Topple Uncaged.
Thank you for having me. It's been amazing chatting with you.
Thank you. And listeners, so this is one of my favourite tracks of Miri's actually as well. It's absolutely beautiful, stunning, fantastic. This is The Plight. So check it out. The Plight, everyone.
I've seen the world in light. I've painted all my colours bright. I sung before the moon took flight. My loss mislaid in space and
that's it. Episode 4 of Topple Uncaged is done. I would like to thank this searingly good Claire Stevenson. Follow her on Twitter. It's at @lady_ClaireUK. And the staggeringly talented Miri. Follow her on Twitter. It's at @MIRIOfficialUK. As always, backstage, I would like to thank my stunning girlfriend, Nicola Jeffrey. Love you lots. Follow her on Twitter. It's at @NicolaCJeffrey. And my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at @Ray_Star113. Last but not least, I would of course like to thank The Canary. Join us. Become a member. All details at www.thecanary.co. I'm off to burn some Christmas trees. Ta-ta.
Uncaged.